They are quite literally the leader's main opposition. They can be one of the leader's most impactful sandpaper people, because a lot of times as a leader, you'll probably spend time trying to manage that person's opposition. Hey, y'all. Welcome back to the Fast Forward Podcast. For today's Out of Scope episode, I want to look at, it's almost like a cult classic, especially in a Black community, but we're going to be talking about Troy Carmichael from Crooklyn. And I'm excited about this episode because we're continuing our conversation on the change shifts that occur as a result of organizational development. And I was thinking about who I wanted to use to discuss specifically employee capacity shifts. I was like, all right, I'm gonna get a really good workplace movie, but that's not, I didn't want to take something that was just obviously work. And I kept thinking and thinking, and Crooklyn came to mind. And I was like, you know what, I'm gonna do Troy. And I like Troy. As I looked more into the movie, thought more about it, I was like, oh, that's actually a really good one, because we see Troy's more than coming of age. We see Troy's role in the family evolve. And through Troy's role in the family evolving, we see the family evolve. And it's so powerful because everybody can relate to it. Obviously, this is the story of a young Black girl growing up in 1970s Brooklyn. It's a Spike Lee joint, so y'all know it's going to be heavy on the New York influences. He's in there as an addict. It is crazy. It's a hilarious movie. If you haven't seen it, please check it out. But everybody can relate to it because it is the story of not only someone finding their voice, but finding their authentic voice. And there are ways that she learns to turn herself up, as well as ways she learns to turn herself down. And we're going to talk about that. And I think that that's important where we're thinking about shifting employee capacity, because let's face it, workplaces work the way that they work because it was working. I'm going to say that again. Workplaces work the way that they work because it was working. Now, whether it was working well or working as dysfunction, it was working. And as leaders, when we go to make changes, we automatically assume that the main points of change we're instituted are going to be the best choice. And we treat it almost like numbers. So if you think about an equation, y equals mx plus b, if I change m, x is going to automatically behave in this way. And then I'm going to shift this and move this around and I'm going to get this y. And people just aren't like that. There are a lot of moving parts. In my book, Evolution to Equity, I talk about roles, and specifically in a section where I speak about the C-suite of a startup. But this could apply to any team, any organization size, or really any group. But the folks that are closest to the head or the leader, which in a company or a startup's case would be the founder, those folks play a triple role, okay? And we all have social, operational, and functional roles. So the functional role is just us doing our job. So are you responsible for marketing? Are you responsible for sales, etc.? The operational roles are what we do to add value to the team's workflows. And in the book, I actually use Belbin's team roles as an example of that. But I'm working on creating my own model. So probably by the time the next season comes out, it might be done, actually. But it's interesting because the social roles are the part that has stood out to so many people, because those are the ones that often don't get named. We don't always have a name for what the empath does for the group, but their presence and their effectiveness is always felt. We don't always have a name for the jester, but we can see the effects of the jester's role in the group. And so when I was thinking about Crooklyn, so much of what Troy experienced as she goes through this movie, and honestly, Now, think about it. The movie, I don't even think it covered a whole calendar year. It might have been maybe like 6 months or so. Could be even shorter than that. But the idea that we get to see her social role in the family shift so dramatically, I think it offers great insights for leaders and entrepreneurs. So when the movie starts, Troy is able to show up as what I call in the book, the foil. So the foil is major confrontation. They push back on the leader constantly. They are quite literally the leader's main opposition. So if the leader says something is up, 9 times out of 10, the foil is going to say, well, are you sure it's not down? Maybe it's down. And so they can be one of the leader's most impactful sandpaper people. Because a lot of times, a leader, you'll probably spend time trying to manage that person's opposition, and it can feel frustrating. So there were tons of points in the movie where her parents and her siblings, because it was all brothers, she was the only girl. She had like 4 or 5 brothers. And where they're like, oh, we just had her, this and that. But what I will say is that the foil plays a very important role because in moments where other people are either afraid of challenging the leader or in an effort to be efficient, like let's just hurry up and get this done, they won't say anything. The foil is like, ah, pump and brakes. What about? So their what aboutism is often the refiner for the team's efforts. And it's interesting because foils also tend to see tons of blind spots that the leader and even the leader's other social roles miss. So if you're the empath or the coddler, you're so busy trying to poo-poo the leader and, oh, massage ego, it's okay, baby, that you won't see certain threats. You might not even see certain opportunities. And so Troy in the movie is a good example of this because she sees the neighbors, she sees the other adults in the community and the potential impact that they can have on the family. She sees social norms changing. She sees the impact of different types of parenting and how it shows up in the confidence that other people have. So I'm thinking of when she was with her cousin, Viola, and how much of what we would call it like a helicopter mom song was. And Troy sees like, okay, I thought my mama was bad, but she ain't like this, man. At least we could chill. We go on the block, right? So even if she doesn't articulate that out loud like that, her seeing this different type of parenting ends up impacting her appreciation for the way she is parented, which previously felt like, oh, I'm so tired of this. And so she ends up asking, hey, can I go home? Like, I'm ready to get out of here. I want to go back home. And it's interesting because her role as the foil, while we probably see it as like this recalcitrant child, it is really her pushing up against systems. Because as a kid, and especially as the only girl other than her mother in the house, she can see the need for a little spiciness. So clearly, her mother is not a wilting flower by any means. Her mother is more than willing to stand up for herself. Her mother is more than willing to stand up for what she believes in. Her mother is willing to argue with the father. Her mother is willing to show up for the kids. She don't play about the neighbors, etc. But her mother is also an owner of herself. So when I think about like the father and his love for jazz music and things like that, and the mother is very much committed to being her own woman and how she shows up and presents herself and thinks. And even in her clear black mama-ness, because she don't play with her kids, she is still giving them the space to develop into the self that they need to be too. And it's interesting because Troy learns to appreciate that when she goes and visits family, especially because she's visiting them for an extended period. At a certain point, though, we see a dramatic shift for Troy. And it ironically kind of occurs before she even goes back home and knows that her mother is sick. But definitely after that point where she shifts from being the foil to now being almost like a pit boss, where she is the final authority. She's a decision maker. She now becomes the organizer. And it's interesting because the shift is seamless, because her mother's presence, no matter how annoying it was at the time, has prepared her to do that job well. And her mother tells her that at the end, when it's like her mother's spirit speaking to her. She is able to become the new version of herself that is needed to exist in the social group, because she already had all the skills needed. It had been deposited into her, but just without requiring it to be activated. Now, this is where we gonna spin it now and talk about, as a leader, why this is important. Because when you are seeking to enact change on your team, in your company, while you can do some in-time development, meaning, hey, we got a new computer system that's coming up. You know, we have a new vertical. We're going to have a new set of management roles that will report. And so you can train people in that moment to be effective in this change. There are some things that you have to already be preparing proactively. So if we take Troy as an example, her ability to manage time and activities in a day had already been deposited in her. So her mother already had a structure of wake up, get dressed, oil your scalp, you know, comb your hair, eat breakfast, clean up, do this, right? So there was a schedule in place. This is how we manage time. This is who you have to manage. So this kid is responsible for these kids, and this kid who was younger is responsible for these under them. So that deposit had already been made, and she was already ready to navigate that. If she had not already had those deposits over time, meaning progressively she is seeing this happen, she would not have what she needs to survive in the new version of the family. And keep in mind, her mother is gone completely. And the father obviously is now a single parent responsible for many children, right? And so he probably ain't really got time to for real teach her like that. Like, that was stuff she needed to already know. I bring that up because as leaders, sometimes we assume, oh, if I just do this training, people should be ready. Or at best, we might say, well, we need a month of training, so we're going to do 3-4 training sessions. But if people have not already been conditioned in core competencies, baseline organizational survival skills, one training is not enough. 3 trainings is not enough, because humans are built for patterns. We love patterns of behavior. We love patterns of thought. We love simplicity. We love repeatability and repetition. And we love to have predictability. It feels uncomfortable when we can't predict. So if you are now training people, for example, to be more collaborative, and you're like, yeah, now instead of us working in silos, this is a popular one, y'all. I have to train on this all the time. Instead of working on in silos, we're going to work in collaboration with each other and get stuff done as a team. Damn, sir, if y'all been moving in this company for 5, 10, 15, 20 years with everybody holding on tightly to the knowledge they know, and I don't share it unless there's something in it for me, I don't care how many little group trainings you have. Guess what? The reward system, the recognition system, the social survival mechanisms have been set up to where I hold on to information until I find out how I'm going to benefit, period. And until you shift that and make appropriate investments that outweigh the investment in that old system, people are not going to change their social role. So Troy was motivated and rewarded for shifting from being a foil to a pit boss, because when she moved to being a pit boss, she could then survive and thrive in the company. And she already had the skills needed to do it. It was really just an activation. So my question to you as a leader is, how have you motivated people to activate the skills needed to survive in this change? And have you invested in giving them the core knowledge, skills, and abilities to make the change? Those are two very important points. The next thing I want to emphasize with Troy is that she was given space to operate in this new social role in her way. So I think sometimes on teams, we are, how can I put this? We are blinded by the halos of people who do a role well enough for us. So for example, if you were the jester, and again, I'll talk about what all of these social roles are in the book. If you were the jester, right, and you're the person who knows how to keep things lighthearted and fun, you tell the right joke at the right time, and you have the right type of humor for leader XYZ, right, Jim Bob, who had been at the company for 30 years, and then Jim Bob retires, and so now Sally Sue come in, and Sally Sue, you know, she don't like slapstick humor. She likes more dark humor, and so your joke's just not hidden for her. How you show up as the jester, even though your style did not change and you're still being yourself because that style doesn't match with what Sally Sue needs to lead the team, it'll seem like you're no longer effective at your job. But the problem is not necessarily your style. The problem is that there was only one way that each leader knew to receive the support that they need. And to be clear with the social roles, you need every social role on a team. Sometimes people embody more than one, but every single role is necessary. And so, and I deal with this a lot too. So I've had a couple of different like VAs and operations managers and executive assistants, and each person has been very different. They've approached differently. They had different like core skill sets, certain things that they did really, really well, certain things they love to do, ways of talking. In fact, each person has been from a different country at that, right? Different style of approaching the work, different types of experience, tenures, et cetera. And so if I am married too hard to how this other person did it, instead of looking objectively at the work and the outcomes, I will punish people unnecessarily and reward other people and reward behaviors unnecessarily too. There's a middle ground for all of that. And as leaders and entrepreneurs, we have to have a pulse on that. So for example, one of my VAs, she was really good at like sending follow-up messages, for example, to say, hey, I'm working on this, I did this. And so when I found someone else and started working with them, in my head, I'm like, I didn't know they was working on that. And thankfully, before I said something to this person, I checked myself. And I was like, all right, one, did you tell them that they needed to send these follow-up messages? Like, is that a behavioral standard for their role? And I was like, no, I didn't say that. Okay. So technically, you can't get mad at them because they didn't send this. Two, did they do their job and you just didn't know it? Meaning they didn't send a follow-up message, but they did what you asked them to do. Yeah, this person did the job and did it really well. Okay, so really it's a style thing. And now let's dig even deeper. Why do you need to follow a message? Well, I realized I needed to follow a message because at the time I was splitting that person's hours between me and someone else who was working in the company. And that person was eating up most of the time. So by the time I would get around to asking for my help, it might not be enough time left. So having that follow-up was helpful so I could track how much of the allocation would be left for me. Guess what? It ain't nobody else right now. You know what I'm saying? So I don't need that. Assign this person their projects, clarify if they have any questions, leave them be. Y'all got 2 check-ins a week to see if there's any questions, this and that. Literally, you're going to talk to this person in like a couple of days. It's not that serious. And so by the time I got to actually have a conversation with them, I had resolved my own emotional overwhelm, right? By thinking through, processing, is it this, asking questions, probing, checking myself. And then I was able to have a conversation with them and say, hey, you know what? Sometimes I might ask you for follow-up, or sometimes in me running, doing a whole bunch of things, it's nice to get a pulse of what you're working on. So periodically, can you just check in with me? And they was like, okay, it was nothing. Had I approached it in my state of emotional hijacking, emotional overwhelm, that conversation would have went totally different. And it's possible it would have caused some irreparable damage to our relationship. And so again, as the leader, when we create that halo bias, right, where, oh, this person was just everything. Or sometimes when we create, right, that pitchfork bias where this person can't never do anything right, what'll happen is we'll carry those same biases into the next role, the next person who comes into that role, and put stuff on them that they didn't even do yet. So we have to take people as they are and allow them to embody a social role, a functional role, and an operational role in their own way. Because everybody has a style of how they do their work. Everybody has an approach. Everybody has strengths and weaknesses in how they do their work. And honestly, most of the time, I'm talking about, I would wager to say 70, 80% of the time, it is not that deep to be trying to check people for every little thing. Period. Like, again, and I'm saying this as a person who obviously manages the team now. There are times where I'm like, you know what? This person messed this up. I'm not even going to tell them. Like, because they've done it right 10 times before. This one little error is really not even worth addressing it. And I'll just fix it real quick. Keep it pushing. Right? Because I know in the grand scheme of their work, the grand scheme of the value they bring, in the grand scheme of the type of energy I want to have in my company, that type of nitpicking is incongruent. It has no place there, because I've worked in work environments where it was nitpicking. So you could do 500 things right and 2 things wrong, and it was like nothing you ever did mattered. And I hated that. And it was so demoralizing and destabilizing. And it made me not appreciate even my own work. And I promised myself I never want to do that to other people. But that involves me checking myself as a leader. The other people are not involved, because everybody's going to make mistakes. I make mistakes with stuff. And so how I choose to show up in myself first before communicating and projecting that stuff outward, it makes all the difference in the world. So again, just going back to Troy, she was allowed to be her own version of a foil, and she was allowed to be her own version of a pit boss. And in both instances, she could play both of those roles effectively, because she could take ownership of not just who and what, but how that role showed up. All right. So again, we're talking about Ms. Troy Carmichael in Crooklyn. What are some of the lessons that you've picked up from Troy? How do you see your own story reflecting our story? It's interesting looking back at it now. I mean, again, it's always a funny movie. Loved it back then. But now, you know, just given different things that have happened in my life, I enjoy it even more. I really love that movie. So let me know your thoughts. What was your favorite scene? There are tons of quotables. So many of your most viral quotes, it probably came from Crooklyn. So tell me, what are some of your favorite quotes from the movie? What are your favorite scenes? Did you like it? If you didn't like it, maybe share why. But yeah, let me know down in the comments. And of course, be sure to like, share, and subscribe. And I will catch y'all on the next one. Bye.